You're listening to the Effective Statistician Podcast, a weekly podcast with Alexander Schacht and Benjamin Pieske, designed to help you reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients without becoming overwhelmed by work. Today we are talking about innovation, play, and failing, an interview with Mike Smith. I really enjoyed this interview with Mike. There's lots of good stuff in it. And if you have been to the PSI conference this year, the virtual one, then you probably heard about his presentation there, as he was a winner of the Joint PSI and RSS Award last year. And so today we are talking a little bit about this webinar, and we actually recorded it pretty much directly after he has presented this webinar. So, as we are talking about PSI, this is really timely because PSI is helping me with this podcast. I'm producing this podcast in association with PSI. And PSI is a community dedicated to leading and promoting the use of statistics within the healthcare industry for the benefit of patients. There's lots of great things with PSI, with what you can develop further your statistical capabilities. For example, there's a video on demand content library. There's a lot of webinars that are going on, and you will get free access to all of these. And there's much more. Just visit the PSI website at psiweb.org to learn more about PSI activities. And don't forget to become a PSI member. Best today. Welcome to a new podcast episode of The Effective Statistician, and today I'm here with an award winner, Mike Smith. Hi, Mike. How are you doing?
Very well, thanks, Alexander.
Very good. We are recording this actually directly after the PSI conference of 2020. This time was a little bit different than the usual PSI conferences, as it was completely virtual due to the overall corona situation. Mike, you just gave a presentation there. How was that?
Very good. Very different as well. I've done a couple of webinars, but doing it at scale where, you know, you don't know how many people are on the line. And actually, I found the hardest bit was not getting any feedback. Normally when I'm presenting, I like to see people's faces and get that feedback and see whether it's working and kind of tailor what I'm saying to how I see people reacting. But so that was about the hardest part, is not getting any feedback on how people are receiving it. But I got some nice feedback via Twitter later.
Oh, that's awesome. Okay, and you talked about a really, really important word for us as statisticians. It's probably an important word for us as an industry or as a society, and that's innovation. And when you speak about innovation, especially for us statisticians, what are you thinking about?
Yeah, so this is something I touched on in the talk. So it's hard, I think, to come up with constructive definitions of innovation. Being inclusive about what innovation is. So actually I defined it by going the opposite way and saying what innovation is not. So I said that I see innovation as anything that can't be defined by business as usual or tried and tested. Mm. You know, if you're working in that sphere where you're just going to go back over something that you've already done and that's what people expect, or you're doing something that's, you know, this is the same way that we've done this time and time again, that's not innovation.
Yeah.
But being defining it that way means that it includes things like just application of existing methods. Yeah. Lots of people think of innovation as being, you know, it has to be blue sky thinking, it has to be completely novel, new theory, new everything. And actually I think it's, you know, a lot of the stuff I've done is just applying something that someone else has discovered.
Yeah, I think that is very often also what I see as being innovative. Innovative means that you bring something new to the organization. It doesn't need to be new to science or society overall, but very often kind of innovation is if you take an approach that is already out there and then apply it to your data. So for example, I was once working on some visualization of data, and I got inspired by this really nice Hans Rosling type of approaches, and then applied that to clinical data. Yeah, so it's not something that then is. It's not new in the sense that nobody has ever done that before. It's just that you kind of combine things. I think that is a really nice way to think about innovation as well.
Yeah, and it also means that in order to do it well, I think you need to be, you know, have your eyes open, be looking out for what you think is, oh, that's interesting. I wonder if I could do that. Mm-hmm. And that kind of, I wonder if, comes on to one of the other points in the talk, which was about being curious and asking, what if I was to apply Hans Rosling's approach to a clinical trial result?
I think the other point is we very often just think in terms of, you know, statistical approaches, like the visualization or a new Bayesian techniques that was just published or a different design approach or things like that. But I think there's lots of other areas we can think about in terms of innovation as well, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I was involved in at Pfizer was looking at different ways of speeding up the reporting process. Mm. So reproducible reporting. You know, can we incorporate some of those ideas of embedding the analytics inside the report so that, you know, things like QC would become easier. It could become faster to update a report when data changes, things like that. You know, so yeah, it's not just the statistical methodology or you know, data science methodology.
Yeah, completely agree. So I think it's something new to the organization, and that helps to create new value. And I think that's an important part that needs to be in there for innovation, because it's not just kind of ivory tower research that comes. Yeah. So if you have a new approach, but that doesn't add value, then yeah, well, that's not innovation for me.
Right. And, you know, I also talk about the drivers for innovation, and typically that comes out of some constraint, right? So either you need to do things faster, you need to do it more cheaply with less resource, or, you know, there is some constraint on the system that you need to somehow get around, and that forces innovation.
Yeah.
You know, if you're sitting there and everything is perfect, well, do you need to innovate? It might be interesting, but it's not necessary. So, you know, I think you're right that it's looking at what's happening today and saying, how could this be better, faster, more efficient? And to be honest, I think that's you know, sits right in the wheelhouse of most statisticians.
Yeah. And I completely agree in terms of constraints. They are really important to drive innovation. I was once hearing about a story of Jeff Bezos that kind of, you know, had lots of different ideas to start a project. And his constraint was that he needed to be able to do it as a side job. So it needed to be something that he can develop kind of in the evening and would still kind of drive forward. And that deleted a lot of kind of options. And that way he came up with Amazon. Yeah. So it's, you can be, so constraints can in that sense be really, really positive.
Mm. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of my current boss talks about trying to boil the ocean. You know, you can't boil the ocean. You've got to take it, you know, one cup at a time. and you know, from that perspective, as you're saying, you know, you have constraints as well.
Yeah.
You know, you can't try to innovate a whole process at once, because that's just too difficult. It's too painful.
Yeah.
So pick out the small bit that you can achieve. Deliver on that and then move on to the next thing. But I think the other thing I realized is that as you're doing that, as you're making that incremental innovation to fix one problem, you need to also have an eye on what the big solution is.
Yeah.
You know, so that you're not just doing something here today that in 1 month or 6 months you'll have to roll back, because actually the bigger thing now means that thing you did earlier doesn't work anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think that is really important to have kind of the big picture in mind. What are the different other initiatives that are going on? Yeah, so that you don't run something that is in parallel with the bigger initiative. So you kind of make things redundant or inconsistent or things like that. And so, therefore, I think it's really important to have a wider network and bigger business understanding of what's going on.
Right. The other thing I was talking about was play, right? And I firmly believe that playing with things will deliver results.
Yeah.
You know, and so there's a danger when you're looking at the big picture and thinking forward and thinking to that 6-month horizon or the 2-year horizon, you know, it's hard to start, right? Whereas sometimes if you just pick out the small element and play with it and find something that works, maybe you do need to unpick that in you know, a month or 6 months. But, you know, you've got something.
You know, yeah. I think that is that's a really good kind of trade-off you need to look into. Yeah, so I also believe this play approach helps you to also discard things faster.
Oh, sure.
If you want to innovate and be innovative, you also need to accept that you will fail. Yeah. I can think of, you know, one time we were thinking about doing stats trainings in-house, more kind of videotape-like and things like that. We tried to record ourselves on video how we explain certain things. And it was a disaster. was just, you know, just kind of the overall equipment that was what would be needed, us not really being professional actors and kind of professional in front of the screen. There were so many elements that just didn't work together that we thought, okay, that's maybe not the right way to go.
Yeah. But you can, in doing that, there must have been some learning that came out, right? So you can say, well, this way doesn't work, you know, but what would we change to make it work next time?
Yeah.
You know, and so I think there's a kind of continuous learning, continuous improvement bit to this, which says, I play with something, I get something, it's not quite right, you know, is it good enough? And if the answer is no, it's really not good enough, then you need to say, well, you know, for the next time, if I've got the same thing that I'm trying to achieve, then what do I change?
Yeah, absolutely. What kind of training do I need? What, you know, can I make it so that it works better? So maybe just talking to slides, for example, in our example, and then, you know, just have a, you know, the headshot somewhere. These kind of ideas came then up. Mm-hmm. So it's exactly right. You need to kind of continue to fail to get to the next step.
Mm-hmm. I think the other thing is about the time. You know, because the time that you take to, you know, perhaps in your example, the training was going to happen anyway. And so you're just recording what's happening anyway. Mm. But then you have time that you need to have to review that and look at it. And if it's right, that's great. So you know you can reuse what you have. But if it's not right, then you need to come back and try again. So you need a lead time there. Mm. You know, so innovation can't happen overnight. You know, if someone phones you on a Friday night and says, I need something really, you know, a really great design for Monday morning's meeting, that's not the time to do that. You know?
Exactly. I think the other thing what I have observed is sometimes it just needs a lot of time to grow in the background. I had lots of ideas about visualizations over years and how to best kind of display how changes from baseline for bigger populations, how that worked out. And then I came across a project where that really helped quite a lot. And that's where then kind of all the different stars aligned. So the project team was happy about it. There was the right resources. That was the right timing. I was just working on the right project, and then it kind of boom, and it went forward like crazy. Yeah, but years before, it kind of got stuck and there was a little bit of movement, and it got stuck again and it kind of was waiting in the background until kind of the perfect situation came up.
Right. And again, I talked about this because there's an element of the context that you do your innovation in. And from what you're saying, earlier context was, we're not quite ready for this. Right. And so I was trying to say that the culture that you're doing your innovation in, and culture here meaning lots of things, right? It means receptiveness. Mm. And the timing with respect to the project and whether they're ready for it and whether your line management are ready to stand behind you and say, this actually is a good idea. Let's carry it forward. So the culture has to be ready for your innovation. And if it's not, right, that doesn't mean it's necessarily a bad idea. It's just that, you know, you need to somehow wait until someone's more receptive to that. Mm. And the point I was trying to make is that you shouldn't just abandon that and say, well, it wasn't a good idea, let's throw it away. Mm-hmm. But rather park it, document it and say, well, I had this idea, I tried it and it didn't fly on this occasion, but here's where it's sitting and it's ready and here's the assumptions I'm making and here's what you need to do so that the next time when we are in a position for it to really make a big impact, I can quickly deploy it.
Yeah, absolutely. It's kind of, do you know this speech by Steve Jobs where he talks about connecting the dots, where he kind of, it's a commencement speak.
I don't think I know that one.
Stanford or something. And he talks about kind of his experience where he worked on calligraphy and he worked on all kind of different things. And then when the Mac got developed, there all these kind of different things came together. So it was, you know, the first computer that had really nice form and these kind of things, whereas all the other computers before had kind of just this one standard form. And then so that is kind of another idea where all these different things need to come up together.
Yeah. And I think, you know, in some respects, you have to be lucky for your innovative idea to work, you know, and for all of these things to align, right? But again, I think if you're practiced at innovation, if you have a good sense, I talk at the end of the slide, presentation about marketing, mm-hmm. right? And marketing to me is about building trust in the team that you're working in, you know, so that they trust your ideas, they trust that you deliver on your ideas. You're also a good steward of other people's ideas that, you know, you basically it's making that culture right for running the idea out. OK, yeah. Now, in that instance, if you're good at doing those kinds of things, then yes, you need luck to make your idea fly. But you can engineer that luck.
Yeah.
By building the relationships, by, you know, so that people can be candid with you and say, Mike, I can see that's a good idea, you know, but we're not ready for it now. Yeah. You know, and they'll be honest with you so that the next time they might go, actually, now is the time that we need to apply that great thing that you thought of.
Yeah.
And so, yes, you know, there's definitely luck in there, but I honestly think that you can engineer a lot of that luckiness, you know, by being perceptive, by seeing that, you know, timing's not quite right for this, so I'll hold back, or talking to the right people at the right time to say, hey, you have a problem here. I have something sitting in my filing system that can solve that problem for you. Would you like to try it?
Yeah. But I think that is also goes into the marketing aspect that we just talked about. You don't say, I have this solution, and then kind of, you know, convince the other side that you need to apply the solution. But what you said was, I think, very valuable in terms of getting it sold. You said, you have this problem.
Yeah.
And you come from the problem, and then you can explain to the other stakeholders, you have this problems in terms of time, in terms of quality, in terms of budget, whatsoever. Mm-hmm. I've thought about this, and here's a solution that would, you know, come to help solve this problem.
Yeah, it's definitely, you know, what makes this work is problem-driven solutions, yep, rather than solution-driven something. You know, yeah. I work a lot in using R and stuff, and I hear lots of people say, we need to use Shiny. But Shiny is the technology, it's the solution. Yeah. You know, I'd rather hear why, you know, what problem is it that you have where you will need to create a Shiny app for it?
Yeah. Yeah. I think people, it's this kind of approach. If you have a hammer, your world
looks like a nail.
Yeah. So that's fine in one regard, but I think it's really, really important to first start from the problem side. Mm-hmm. And then go to the kind of tools. It's, you know, not everything needs a Bayesian analysis. Not everything needs some kind of super sophisticated analysis. If a t-test does a really good job, well, then it's maybe just a t-test. It's a problem that is solved, so don't you know, engineer something into it.
I have things to say about that as well, about p-values, but that's a different topic altogether. but you're right. You know, if there's a simple decision to be made, maybe all you need is a simple method.
Yeah. In terms of this driving these innovations forward, that for me has also a lot kind of to do with change management. Mm. Because you need to, you know, get it more broader kind of accepted, and, you know, culturally kind of we are as people, the most of us are rather resistant to change. Yeah. Mm. So kind of the vast majority of people are rather resistant to change. What's your kind of experience in kind of, you know, rolling out innovations to kind of, you know, to a bigger group? It's maybe not just kind of the physicians that you work with that you need to convince, but a bigger group of people that you want to convince on an innovation.
Yeah, I've had experience of that. I mean, I've in the last 2 years, I've been working on a big software project at Pfizer for the clinical pharmacology department. And it was essentially our workbench where we do all the work that goes into submission, regulatory submission for and reporting for clinical pharmacology. It was replacing a system that had been there for about 15 years.
Yeah.
We're taking away a system that colleagues have been familiar with for a long, long time. And yes, there were pros and cons of that system, but people had been using it and they knew how it worked, and it had that ingrained, yes, I'm familiar with this, and replacing it with something new. And actually, you make a fantastic point that we had to actually engage with professionals to talk about change management, you know, and prepare the ground. So it's plowing the field, getting people ready for that change. Something's coming. Don't be afraid of it. You know, let them know in advance that this new thing is coming. Demonstrate that new thing. You know, let me show you how it works. Let me reassure you that it's not going to be completely unfamiliar when we make that change.
Yeah.
And then also show that it's good enough. You know, so it will continue to do the things you need it to do for your reports because, you know, you're on a time constraint. You can't afford this to be different.
Yeah.
But then acknowledge that for some people, there will be there's the curve of adoption where you have the early adopters that go, oh, wow, this is great. This is new. I'm excited about this. Let's get in and use it and see what it can do. And then there's a kind of later lag phase where the majority of people come on. And some of those people will like it. And some of the people will find issues with it and problems with it, but could probably live with what they're seeing. And then there's the tail end of that change curve, where the people who didn't want to change in the first place are now forced into that new thing.
Yeah.
And so you need to be, as the person rolling out the change, you need to be ready for the excitement initially, which is great. And that's the thing that motivates us when we're rolling out something new. You've got people out there, wow, that looks fantastic. I'm really excited about this. But then you've got to acknowledge that there will be people who are sitting there going, I'm really uncomfortable with this. I'm going to hold off using it until the last second when I'm forced to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. There's this awesome book about change management called Our Iceberg is Melting by Steve Kotler. Do you know that?
I don't, but just the title makes me know that it's going to be a good book.
It's an awesome story about change management. The story is that there's pendulums that sit on an iceberg, and then there's Fred, the curious person that finds out that the iceberg is melting. Then, you know, he speaks about that, and then there's this big committee that runs the colony and how he gets them to convince to act something like this. And then there's, of course, the pension that it's called no-no, that is completely against everything. Yeah. So, it's a really, really nice read. It's about, probably you can read it in 90 minutes or something like this with lots of illustrations, but it talks about all these different aspects of change management. And it exactly talks to the point that you just made. Yeah. In terms of you need to have some early adopters that, take it and create some good examples, some use cases. It's really awesome if you can identify them early in the project, because then you can even incorporate them in the delivery of the creation of the innovative project, because then you already have some stakeholders in the kind of groups that you want to convince that have expertise in this area, but more often, more important also, they have some, you know, recognition, trust. They are people that others refer to and that are kind of not outsiders. So having these kind of insiders that speak positively about your change management is really, really important.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's exactly how we did it with this big software tool, because we had our early adopters in, as you see, very early actually working with the system. Mm-hmm. Because we're talking about, I don't know, maybe up to 200 different colleagues actually using the system at the end of the day. You know, you can't, as an individual, hope to convince 200 people.
Yeah.
But if you found, say, 20 across the different places in your organization who can be local advocates for what's happening and go to speak to their friends that they drink coffee with or have lunch with and go, you know, it's not that bad. I've played with it for 6 months and, you know, there's some good things about it. You know, those are the people who are really going to help the change.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's then really kind of continued presentations about it, continued education about it, make it really, really easy for people, but also kind of strategically foresee what are all the questions that people will have. And sure, so that you have set all your question and answer documents in place for that.
But even on a smaller scale, you know, I've done some stuff where, you know, I've had an idea, I roll it out, and I think it's a great idea, right? And the fact that it exists should make other people excited about it, you know? And that's not how you do things, you know, unless you have something like an iPhone that a million people are just going to go, that's fantastic. You know, if you have a new R package and you release it and you push it to CRAN, most of the world is just going to go, okay. And so, you know, you have to have friends, colleagues, you know, people from outside your organization who can be equally excited about this.
Yeah.
You know, and it's, I talk about if you build it, they will come. You know, the field of dreams analogy, where if you build a baseball field in your backyard, then something magical will happen. That almost never happens in practice.
Yeah.
You need to tell people, you need to get the word out somehow. So.
Yeah, I think that is a general kind of theme that I see quite a lot, that it's weird, you know, as statisticians overall kind of more introverted. And I think in the overall industry where there's also a lot of extroverted people, maybe more coming from marketing and sales and other areas, we kind of get lost in the noise. Yeah. So I think we need to become much more, much better in terms of how we communicate, how we market ourselves, and kind of that shouldn't be something that is bad. I think the mindset for that should be we are actually doing a disservice to the organization or to the scientific society if we don't promote it.
And you know, this is the point I was trying to make about marketing as well. You know, I recognize that many statisticians feel uncomfortable about marketing generally. You know, they say, well, you know, here are the facts. And, you know, I don't need you to spin those facts. I don't need you to promote bigger than I think it is because I know the uncertainty in those numbers. You know, and so I have uncertainty about them. So you shouldn't be certain. You know, and also that there's a feeling that marketing generally involves being extrovert, right? Yeah. But I think the point I was trying to make, I recognize that the introverted more, it's not even the more introverted, but it's the having uncertainty about stuff is natural to a statistician. Yeah. So marketing seems to eliminate that uncertainty. So as a statistician, I'm trying to say that marketing your work, marketing your idea, marketing even your graph or your result, because that's what you have to do to convince people and to get them to use that to make a decision. That marketing is not necessarily about being extrovert and handing out business cards and being overly enthusiastic about something that you have a lot of uncertainty about. It's about building those relationships and trust. You know, I have a track record of helping you make good decisions.
Yeah.
So I'm not asking you to, you know, print out my results on a flag and put it on a flagpole. You know, I'm just talking about, you know, take on what I'm saying and, you know, use it because you know me and because you trust what I've done in the past.
Yeah.
You know, that doesn't involve being overtly extrovert or anything like that. That's just having that ongoing relationship with your team, with the people you work with the customers, whoever it is.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's really about three different things. It's about showing that you care for them in terms of that you take where they're coming from, and that people see that you have a good competence, which I think usually we as statisticians have. And also what usually comes a lot really easily for us statisticians is the character part. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think generally we are seen as a function that has a high integrity and we want to do things right. I think the, let's say, downside to that is we want to be overly precise and overly accurate and have all the details in there. And then with this kind of, to make it 100% correct. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And when you want to, you know, communicate something, I think it's not so much about having all the details in there, but first it's about getting the main message across.
Right.
And so that's also what is, you know, what is in marketing. It's not about kind of, you know, getting all the bells and whistles about there and all the kind of limitations and strengths and whatsoever. That is important. But, you know, first get the main point across and then you can speak about all the other things.
Right. And I don't think I've ever met a statistician who wanted the people they're working with to make bad decisions.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, the actively trying to subvert and make the organization do something wrong. You know, I honestly believe that most statisticians want the right decision to be made. And so to that point, you know, it's the, if you start from that position where you're saying, I want you to make a good decision.
Yeah.
Right. Then instead of saying, you know, I don't know, I fully agree with wanting everything to be super precise, I would say more statisticians say, here's what I'm seeing. I have uncertainty. You also should have uncertainty, and you should acknowledge that uncertainty.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I think a lot of times in making the decision, people ignore the uncertainty.
Yeah.
And you know, p-values help with that because it's a hard and fast black or white result. But let's not go there. But the other thing that's really vital for statisticians to remember is that that decision will be made whether people buy your result or not.
Yeah.
You know, so you have to say a decision has to be made. Let me try and help you make a good decision. And, you know, hopefully incorporating some of the uncertainty in what I'm seeing.
Yeah. One other aspect in terms of innovation and also this change management and all these kind of other things that we talked about is learning about that. How did you learn about that? What kind of support did you have to you know, get better in this innovative ways and selling innovations and things like that?
I think it's practice.
Mm. You know,
it's playing with stuff. And I make the point that playing with a purpose becomes practice. And so, you know, I play at applying methods, you know, or I play at trying to wire together software A and software B. And oftentimes that's outside of my house burning down, you know, project crisis. You know, when you have a little bit of spare time, play with things, see if you've never used Shiny before. You know, try to make an app, see what happens, see what you can and can't do with it. And really, in terms of learning how to innovate, it's just doing that. It's just playing with things to the point where you pick up skills along the way. So I now know how to wire together software A, software B. I know how to create a Shiny app. So I'm now ready that if it turns out that the project team needs me to do something that wires together software A, software B, and make a Shiny app, I can do that.
Mm.
In terms of rolling out and selling that, you know, I think being honest with yourself when it comes to failure is the important part. You know, being ready for things to fail and then knowing why it failed and then how to turn that around and go, okay, you know, rather than push something that I don't think is 100% ready or 100% right, I'll back off. You know, this is not the time to roll out that new thing.
Okay.
Either because the organization's ready or it's not good enough or, you know, I haven't completed it enough. And really, I think it's not, I didn't go to a class on innovation. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't get taught in my MSc about innovation. And so really it just comes down to I've done enough of it that I can sense when, you know, this is going to work. This is a good idea. The organization's ready. So let's do something with it.
What other support did you have to, you know, get more into this innovation
area? Well, I learned from some really excellent people. So, you know, I did a lot of the kind of early innovation stuff with Andy Grieve when he worked at Pfizer. And, you know, he was a great advocate and someone who would stand behind you and look over your shoulder and go, you know, this is nice, but try tweaking this. But also he had the ideas, you know, and so he would come up with, I wonder if we can do this. And then I would work with him to, you know, see if that could be done. So having that mentor to come up with the ideas and then working with that person to implement it, you know, is great training because you're in safe hands, because that's someone who's done this enough themselves that, you know, they can just bounce off you and go, you know, I think this is ready, or I don't think it's ready, or this is fantastic, or not quite there yet. You know, so having those mentors is really important. The other thing is having good bosses, having good managers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, having a manager that will allow you the time and cut you slack to play. you know, yes, Mike, I know you're not very busy, but why on earth are you trying to wire together software A and software B? You know, if you have a manager that goes, I see you're playing, it's playing in the right kind of setting. You know, you're trying to wire together software A and software B. I don't know why, but I'll trust that, you know what you're aiming for here. But also having the managers that go, playing is good, I'll give you the time. But then at the end of it, I want to see what you've done. Yeah. And I want you to report back and tell me what you've learned.
Yeah. So then also in telling it and things like that. Yeah.
Those two things, good mentors and good managers, you can go on a long way with those.
One other thing that I found really helpful for me in the past is also having good kind of colleagues and a network. Yeah. So, for example, I'm not really a good programmer. And lots of the ideas that I have involve programming. So having some people that have these kind of complementary skills and chatting with them about it and trying things out is also, I think, really, really helpful. So.
Yeah, you seldom can do it on your own. Mm. You're going to need to find other people who can help.
I
would be really surprised if anyone can go start of an idea to finish. You know, you'd have to be exceptional in so many areas. But at the same time, you know, there was a question during the talk yesterday about people who work, you know, as self-employed or contractors or consultants. You know, when you're on your own, how do you do this? And that's tough, you know, because as you're playing, as you're trying out stuff, you know, clients are not going to pay you just to sit and play with things, unless that's explicitly part of a contract.
Yeah.
And so, you know, my response to that was about perhaps this is a business development thing. You know, you learning this new skill or you trying out this new idea, you know, perhaps that's something that you could then, you know, offer to a client to say, hey, I've developed this new method for going from A to B quickly and efficiently and with less resource. You know, that is now a differentiating factor for my, you know, for my contract. But the other thing is finding external people. So if you don't have internal programmers and colleagues and friends who can come alongside and go, oh, I see you're trying to do this, let me help, then finding external people who can do that is equally important. And that's why we go to conferences, right?
Yeah, yeah. That's one of the reasons we go to conferences for sure. Yeah, these conferences help you to have this network of other people that are like-minded and that want to go into the same direction. I remember one thing that I was really passionate about, and I didn't have someone within my company that I could drive that forward with, but there was a person that was leading a CRO that was really interested in this topic. And we basically met over some drinks in the evening to just chat about it. Yeah. Because it was just fun to talk about it and to bounce off some ideas about it. And that actually developed in some really, really nice solutions. And I could foresee that, you know, if you have if there's other contractors, if there's other freelancers, if you have, you know, smaller CROs that you work with and where you know the right people, I think these kind of environments can help drive forward innovations in that area. Or maybe someone in academia that, you know, is interested in that.
Yeah. Indeed. You know, building your network will get you a long way as well.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Okay. We talked a little bit about the PSI conference already, and you gave a presentation about this topic. We touched on p-values quite a lot. And well, there is also an interesting session this year on that topic. Both your presentation as well as the one about the p-values, and lots of other things, including also Deborah Ashby's presentation. I had Deborah earlier here on the podcast to speak about Florence Nightingale and a couple of topics around that. All of these will also sit on the video on demand platform of PSI. So you can
find further resources all there and try to make sure that we have links to these different things in the podcast notes. Mike, any final thoughts about innovation? Because we talked a lot about what innovation is. We talked about why it's important, how you can get to it, how you can roll it out, what, you know, fosters innovation, what kind of may derail innovation, how to think about it. So any final thoughts about this topic?
Keep practicing. Practice innovation. Because the more you practice innovation, you'll get better at it.
Awesome. Thanks so much for this really, really nice chat. And hopefully see you soon at one of the PSI events after this corona time. Now we just see ourselves kind of virtually, but would be nice to get then in contact as well. And maybe then we come across some listeners of this podcast episode and can further chat about this topic.
Yeah. Thanks, Alexander.
This show was created in association with PSI. Thanks to Rain, who helps with the show in the background, and thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed the show so much as I did when I recorded it. Please visit theeffectivestatistician.com, where you can sign up for the newsletter so you don't miss anything that is offered for free, additional content, and any announcement in terms of upcoming episodes and these type of things. So head over to theeffectivestatistician.com and sign up for the newsletter. As always, reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients. Just be an effective statistician.